but there much skill is required. Therefore, one part of the Lorzrot deals solely with those who would follow the sword and join the war word of Lord's Keep. But there have been no wars in our time, and in my years at the Lorzrot, the war word numbered scarcely 2,000 men and women. Thus, the chief work of the Lorzrot is in teaching and studying the language and knowledge of the Earth Power. First, the new learners are taught the history of the land, the prayers and songs and legends. In time, all that is known of the old lords and their struggles against the Grey Slayer. Those who master this become lore wardens. They teach others, or search out new knowledge and power from the First Ward. The price of such mastery is high. Such purity and determination and insight and courage are required by Kevin's lore. And there are some, she said, as if she were resolved not to spare her own feelings, who cannot match the need. I failed when that which I learned made my heart quail, when the lore wardens led me to see just a little way into the despite of the Grey Slayer. That I could not bear, and so I broke my devotion and returned to Mithilstone Down to use the little that I knew for my people. And now, when I have forgotten so much, my trial is upon me. She sighed deeply, as if it grieved her to consent to her fate. But that is no matter. In the Lorzrot, those who follow and master both sword and staff, who earn a place in the war word and among the lore wardens, and who do not turn away to pursue private dreams in isolation, as do the unfettered, those brave hearts are named lords, and they join the council which guides the healing and protection of the land. From their number they choose the High Lord to act for all as the lore requires, and one High Lord to wield the law to keep all uncorrupt Earth's power's core. In my years at the Lorzrot, the High Lord was Varial Tamaranthamate, son of Pentil. But he was old, even for a lord, and the lords live longer than other folk. And our Stone Down has had no news of Revelstone or Lorzrot for many years. I do not know who leads the council now. Without thinking, Covenant said, Prothol, son of Dwillian. Atiaran gasped. He knows me. As a lore warden, he taught me the first prayers. He will remember that I failed, and will not trust my mission. She shook her head in pain. Then, after a moment's reflection, she added, And you have known this. You know all. Why do you seek to shame the rudeness of my knowledge? That is not kind. Hellfire, Covenant snapped. Her reproach made him suddenly angry. Everybody in this whole business, you and... But he could not bring himself to say Lena's name. And everyone keep accusing me of being some sort of closet expert. I tell you, I don't know one damn thing about this unless someone explains it to me. I'm not your bloody Beric. Atiaran gave him a look full of skepticism, the fruit of long, harsh self-doubt, and he felt an answering urge to prove himself in some way. He stopped, pulled himself erect against the weight of his pack. This is the message of Lord Foul the Despiser. Say to the Council of Lords, and to High Lord Prothol, son of Dwillian, that the uttermost limit of their span of days upon the land is 7 times 7 years from this present time. Before the end of those days are numbered, I will have the command of life and death in my hand. Abruptly he caught himself. His words seemed to beat down the file like ravens, and he felt a hot leper's shame in his cheeks, as though he had defiled the day. For an instant, complete stillness surrounded him. The birds were as silent as if they had been stricken out of the sky, and the stream appeared motionless. In the noon heat, his flesh was slick with sweat. For that instant, Atyaran gaped aghast at him. Then she cried, "Melancurian Abatha, do not speak it until you must. I cannot preserve us from such ills." The silence shuddered, passed. The stream began chattering again, and a bird swooped by overhead. Covenant wiped his forehead with an unsteady hand. "Then stop treating me as if I'm something I'm not."
"How can I?" she responded heavily. "You are closed to me, Thomas Covenant. I do not see you."
She used the word "see" as if it meant something he did not understand. "What do you mean you don't see me?" he demanded sourly. "I'm standing right in front of you."
"You are closed to me," she repeated. "I do not know whether you are well or ill."
He blinked at her uncertainly, then realized that she had unwittingly given him a chance to tell her about his leprosy. He took the opportunity. He was angry enough for the job now. Putting aside his incomprehension, he grated, "Ill, of course. I'm a leper." At this, Atyaran groaned as if he had just confessed to a crime.
"Then woe to the land, for you have the wild magic and can undo us all."
"Will you cut that out?" Brandishing his left fist, he gritted, "It's just a ring. To remind me of everything I have to live without. It's got no more wild magic than a rock."
"The earth is the source of all power," whispered Atyaran.
With an effort, Covenant refrained from shouting his frustration at her. She was talking past him, reacting to him as if his words meant something he had not intended. "Back up a minute," he said. "Let's get this straight. I said I was ill. What does that mean to you? Don't you even have diseases in this world?" For an instant, her lips formed the word "diseases." Then a sudden fear tightened her face, and her gaze sprang up past Covenant's left shoulder. He turned to see what frightened her. He found nothing behind him, but as he scanned the west rim of the file, he heard a scrabbling noise. Pebbles and shale fell into the cut.
"The follower," Atyaran cried. "Run, run!"
Her urgency caught him. He spun and followed her as fast as he could go down the file. Momentarily, he forgot his weakness, the weight of his pack, the heat. He pounded after Atyaran's racing heels as if he could hear his pursuer poised above him on the rim of the file. But soon his lungs seemed to be tearing under the exertion, and he began to lose his balance. When he stumbled, his fragile body almost struck the ground. Atyaran shouted, "Run!" But he hauled up short, swung trembling around to face the pursuit. A leaping figure flashed over the edge of the cut and dropped toward him. He dodged away from the plummet, flung up his arms to ward off the figure's swinging arm. As the attacker passed, he scored the backs of Covenant's fingers with a knife. Then he hit the ground and rolled, came to his feet with his back to the east wall of the cut, his knife weaving threats in front of him. The sunlight seemed to etch everything starkly in Covenant's vision. He saw the unevenness of the wall, the shadows stretched under them like rictus. The attacker was a young man with a powerful frame and dark hair, unmistakably a stone downer, though taller than most. His knife was made of stone, and woven into the shoulders of his tunic was his family insignia, a pattern like crossed lightning. Rage and hate strained his features as if his skull were splitting. "Raver," he yelled.
"Ravisher."
He approached, swinging his blade. Covenant was forced to retreat until he stood in the stream, ankle deep in cool water. Atyaran was running toward them, though she was too far away to intervene between Covenant and the knife. Blood welled from the backs of his fingers.
His pulse throbbed in the cuts, throbbed in his fingertips. He heard Atyaran's commanding shout, "Triarch!" The knife slashed closer. He saw it as clearly as if it were engraved on his eyeballs. His pulse pounded in his fingertips. The young man gathered himself for a killing thrust. Atyaran shouted again, "Triarch, are you mad? You swore the oath of peace." In his fingertips. He snatched up his hand, stared at it, but his sight was suddenly dim with awe. He could not grasp what was happening. "That's impossible," he breathed in the utterest astonishment. "Impossible." His numb, leprosy-ridden fingers were aflame with pain. Atyaran neared the two men and stopped, dropped her pack to the ground. She seemed to place a terrible restraint on Triarch. He thrashed viciously where he stood. As if he were choking on passion, he spat out, "Kill him, Raver!" "I forbid," cried Atyaran. The intensity of her command struck Triarch like a physical blow. He staggered back a step, then threw up his head and let out a hoarse snarl of frustration and rage. Her voice cut sharply through the sound. "Loyalty is due. You took the oath. Do you wish to damn the land?" Triarch shuddered. In one convulsive movement, he flung down his knife so that it drove itself to the hilt in the ground by his feet. Straightening fiercely, he hissed at Atyaran, "He has ravished Lena. Last night." Covenant could not grasp the situation. Pain was a sensation, a splendor his fingers had forgotten. He had no answer to it except impossible. Impossible. Unnoticed, his blood ran red and human down his wrist. A spasm twitched across his face. Darkness gathered in the air about him. The atmosphere of the file seethed as if it were full of beating wings, claws which flashed toward his face. He groaned, "Impossible." But Atyaran and Triarch were consumed with each other. Their eyes avoided him as if he were a plague spot. As Triarch's words penetrated her, she crumbled to her knees, covered her face with her hands, and dropped her forehead to the ground. Her shoulders shook as if she were sobbing, though she made no sound. And over her anguish, he said bitterly, "I found her in the hills when this day's sun first touched the plains. You know my love for her. I observed her at the gathering and was not made happy by the manner in which this fell stranger dazzled her. It wrung my heart that she should be so touched by a man whose comings and goings no one could ever know. So, late at night, I inquired of Trell, your husband, and learned that she said she meant to sleep with a friend, Teras, daughter of Honoria. Then I inquired of Teras, and she knew nothing of Lena's purpose. Then a shadow of fear came upon me, for when have any of the people been liars? I spent the whole of the night searching for her, and at first light I found her, her shift rent and blood about her. She strove to flee from me, but she was weak from cold and pain and sorrow, and in a moment she clung in my arms and told me what this Raver had done. Then I took her to Trell, her father. While he cared for her, I went away, purposing to kill the stranger. When I saw you, I followed, believing that my purpose was yours also, that you led him into the hills to destroy him. But you meant to save him. Him, the ravisher of Lena, your daughter. How has he corrupted your heart? You forbid, Atyaran, Trellmate. She was a child fair enough to make a man weep for joy at seeing her. broken without consent or care? Answer me. What have oaths to do with us?
The wild, rabid swirl of dark wings forced Covenant down until he was huddled in the stream. Images reeled across his brain, memories of the leprosarium, of doctors saying, "You cannot hope." He had been hit by a police car. He had walked into town to pay his phone bill, in person. In a voice abstract with horror, he murmured, "Can't happen." Slowly, Atiyaran raised her head and spread her arms, as if opening her breast to an impaling thrust from the sky. Her face was carved with pain, and her eyes were dark craters of grief, looking inward on her compromised humanity.
"Trell, help me," she breathed weakly.
Then her voice gathered strength, and her anguish seemed to make the air about her ache.
"Alas, alas for the young of the world. Why is the burden of hating ill so hard to bear? Ah, Lena, my daughter, I see what you have done. I understand. It is a brave deed, worthy of praise and pride. Forgive me that I cannot be with you in this trial."
But after a while, her gaze swung outward again. She climbed unsteadily to her feet and stood swaying for a moment before she rasped hoarsely,
"Loyalty is due. I forbid your vengeance."
"Does he go unpunished?" protested Triok.
"There is peril in the land," she answered. "Let the lords punish him."
A taste of blood sharpened her voice.
"They will know what to think of a stranger who attacks the innocent."
Then her weakness returned.
"The matter is beyond me. Triok, remember your oath."
She gripped her shoulders, knotted her fingers in the leaf pattern of her robe as if to hold her sorrow down. Triok turned toward Covenant. There was something broken in the young man's face, a shattered or wasted capacity for contentment, joy. He snarled with the force of an anathema,
"I know you, unbeliever. We will meet again."
Then abruptly he began moving away. He accelerated until he was sprinting, beating out his reproaches on the hard floor of the file. In a moment, he reached a place where the west wall sloped away, and then he was out of sight, gone from the cut into the hills.
"Impossible," Covenant murmured. "Can't happen. Nerves don't regenerate."
But his fingers hurt as if they were being crushed with pain. Apparently, nerves did regenerate in the land. He wanted to scream against the darkness and the terror, but he seemed to have lost all control of his throat, voice, self. As if from a distance made great by abhorrence or pity, Atiyaran said,
"You have made of my heart a wilderland."
"Nerves don't regenerate." Covenant's throat clenched as if he were gagging, but he could not scream.
"They don't." "Does that make you free?"
she demanded softly, bitterly.
"Does it justify your crime?"
"Crime?" He heard the word like a knife thrust through the beating wings.
"Crime?"
His blood ran from the cuts as if he were a normal man, but the flow was decreasing steadily. With a sudden convulsion, he caught hold of himself, cried miserably,
"I'm in pain."
The sound of his wail jolted him, knocked the swirling darkness back a step.
Pain.
The impossibility bridged a gap for him. Pain was for healthy people. People whose nerves were alive.
"Can't happen. Of course it can't. That proves it. Proves this is all a dream.
All at once he felt an acute desire to weep. But he was a leper, and had spent too much time learning to dam such emotional channels. Lepers could not afford grief. Trembling feverishly, he plunged his cut hand into the stream.
"Pain is pain," Atyaran grated. "What is your pain to me? You have done a black deed, unbeliever. Violent and cruel, without commitment or sharing. You have given me a pain that no blood or time will wash clean. And Lena, my daughter, I pray that the lords will punish. Punish."
The running water was chill and clear. After a moment, his fingers began to sting in the cold, and an ache spread up through his knuckles to his wrist. Red plumed away from his cuts down the stream, but the cold water soon stopped his bleeding. As he watched the current rinse clean his injury, his grief and fear turned to anger. Because Atyaran was his only companion, he growled at her, "Why should I go? None of this matters. I don't give a damn about your precious land."
"By the Seven."
Atyaran's hard tone seemed to chisel words out of the air.
"You will go to Revelstone if I must drag you each step of the way."
He lifted his hand to examine it. Triarch's knife had sliced him as neatly as a razor. There were no jagged edges to conceal dirt or roughen the healing. But the cut had reached bone in his middle two fingers, and blood still seeped from them. He stood up. For the first time since he had been attacked, he looked at Atyaran. She stood a few paces from him, with her hands clenched together at her heart as if its pulsing hurt her. She glared at him abominably, and her face was taut with intimations of fierce, rough strength. He could see that she was prepared to fight him to Revelstone if necessary. She shamed him, aggravated his ire. Belligerently, he waved his injury at her.
"I need a bandage."
For an instant, her gaze intensified as if she were about to hurl herself at him. But then she mastered herself, swallowed her pride. She went over to her pack, opened it, and took out a strip of white cloth, which she tore at an appropriate length as she returned to Covenant. Holding his hand carefully, she inspected the cut, nodded her approval of its condition, then bound the soft fabric firmly around his fingers.
"I have no hurt, Loam," she said, "and cannot take the time to search for it. But the cut looks well and will heal cleanly."
When she was done, she went back to her pack. Swinging it onto her shoulders, she said,
"Come. We have lost time."
Without a glance at Covenant, she set off down the file. He remained where he was for a moment, tasting the ache of his fingers. There was a hot edge to his hurt, as if the knife were still in the wound. But he had the answer to it now. The darkness had receded somewhat, and he could look about him without panic. Yet he was still afraid. He was dreaming healthy nerves. He had not realized that he was so close to collapse. Helpless, lying unconscious somewhere, he was in the grip of a crisis of his ability to survive. To weather it, he would need every bit of discipline or intransigence he could find. On an impulse, he bent and tried to pull Triarch's knife from the ground with his right hand. His half-grip slipped when he tugged straight up on the handle, but by working it back and forth, he was able to loosen it, draw it free. The whole knife was shaped and polished out of one flat sliver of stone, with a haft leather bound for a secure hold and an edge that seemed sharp enough for shaving. He tested it on his left forearm and found that it lifted off his hair as smoothly as if the blade were lubricated. He slipped it under his belt. Then he hitched his pack higher on his shoulders and started after Atyaran. Chapter 9. Jehanam. Before the afternoon was over, he had lapsed into a dull, hypnotized throb of pain. His pack straps constricted the circulation in his arms, multiplied the aching of his hand. His damp socks gave him blisters to which his toes were acutely and impossibly sensitive. Weariness made his muscles as awkward as lead. But Atiyaran moved constantly, severely ahead of him down the file, and he followed her as if he were being dragged by the coercion of her will. His eyes became sightless with fatigue. He lost all sense of time, of movement, of everything except pain. He hardly knew that he had fallen asleep, and he felt a detached, impersonal sense of surprise when he was finally shaken awake. He found himself lying in twilight on the floor of the file. After rousing him, Atiyaran handed him a bowl of hot broth. Dazedly, he gulped at it. When the bowl was empty, she took it and handed him a large flask of spring wine. He gulped it also. From his stomach, the spring wine seemed to send long, soothing fingers out to caress and relax each of his raw muscles, loosening them until he felt that he could no longer sit up. He adjusted his pack as a pillow, then lay down to sleep again. His last sight before his eyes fell shut was of Atiyaran, sitting enshadowed on the far side of the graveling pot, her face set relentlessly toward the north. The next day dawned clear, cool, and fresh. Atiyaran finally succeeded in awakening Covenant as darkness was fading from the sky. He sat up painfully, rubbed his face as if it had gone numb during the night. A moment passed before he recollected the new sensitivity of his nerves. Then he flexed his hands, stared at them as if he had never seen them before. They were alive. Alive. He pushed the blanket aside to uncover his feet. When he squeezed his toes through his boots, the pain of his blisters answered sharply. His toes were as alive as his fingers. His guts twisted sickly. With a groan, he asked himself, "How long? How long is this going to go on?" He did not feel that he could endure much more. Then he remembered that he had not had on a blanket when he went to sleep the night before. Atiyaran must have spread it over him. He winced, avoided her eyes by shambling woodenly to the stream to wash his face. Where did she find the courage to do such things for him? As he splashed cold water on his neck and cheeks, he found that he was afraid of her again. But she did not act like a threat. She fed him, checked the bandage on his injured hand, packed up the camp as if he were a burden to which she had already become habituated. Only the lines of sleeplessness around her eyes and the grim set of her mouth showed that she was clenching herself. When she was ready to go, he gave himself a deliberate VSE, then forced his shoulders into the straps of his pack and followed her down the file as if her stiff back were a demand he could not refuse. Before the day was done, he was an expert on that back. It never compromised. It never admitted a doubt about its authority, never offered the merest commiseration. Though his muscles tightened until they became as inarticulate as bone, though the aching rictus of his shoulders made him hunch in his pack like a cripple, though the leagues aggravated his sore feet until he hobbled along like a man harried by vultures, her back compelled him like an ultimatum. Keep moving or go mad. I permit no other alternatives. And he could not deny her. She stalked ahead of him like a nightmare figure, and he followed as if she held the key to his existence. Late in the morning, they left the end of the file and found themselves on a heathered hillside almost directly north of the high, grim finger of Kevin's watch. They could see the south plains off to the west, and as soon as the file ended, the stream turned that way, flowing to some distant union with the middle. But Atiyaran led Covenant still northward, weaving her way along fragmentary tracks and across unpathed leas which bordered the hills on her right. To the west, the grasslands of the plains were stiff with bracken, purplish in the sunlight. And to the east, the hills rose calmly, cresting a few hundred feet higher than the path which Atiyaran chose along their sides. In this middle ground, the heather alternated with broad swaths of bluegrass.
The hillsides wore flowers and butterflies around thick copses of wattle and clusters of taller trees, oaks and sycamores, a few elms, and some gold-leaved trees. Atyarin called them gilden, which looked like maples.
All the colors, the trees, the heather and bracken, the alayantha, the flowers, and the infinite azure sky, were vibrant with the eagerness of spring, lush and exuberant rebirth of the world. But Covenant had no strength to take in such things. He was blind and deaf with exhaustion, pain, incomprehension. Like a penitent, he plodded on through the afternoon at Atyarin's behest. At last the day came to an end. Covenant covered the final league, staggering numbly, though he did not pass out on his feet as he had the previous day. And when Atyarin halted and dropped her pack, he toppled to the grass like a felled tree. But his overstrained muscles twitched as if they were appalled. He could not hold them still without clenching. In involuntary restlessness, he helped Atyarin by unpacking the blankets while she cooked supper. During their meal, the sun set across the plains, streaking the grasslands with shadows and lavender, and when the stars came out, he lay and watched them, trying with the help of spring wine to make himself relax. At last, he faded into sleep, but his slumbers were troubled. He dreamed that he was trudging through a desert hour after hour, while a sardonic voice urged him to enjoy the freshness of the grass. The pattern ran obsessively in his mind until he felt that he was sweating anger. When the dawn came to wake him, he met it as if it were an affront to his sanity. He found that his feet were already growing tougher, and his cut hand had healed almost completely. His overt pain was fading, but his nerves were no less alive. He could feel the ends of his socks with his toes, could feel the breeze on his fingers. Now the immediacy of these inexplicable sensations began to infuriate him. They were evidence of health, vitality, a wholeness he had spent long, miserable months of his life learning to live without, and they seemed to inundate him with terrifying implications. They seemed to deny the reality of his disease. But that was impossible. "It's one or the other," he panted fiercely. "Not both. Either I'm a leper or I'm not. Either Joan divorced me or she never existed. There's no middle ground." With an effort that made him grind his teeth, he averred, "I'm a leper. I'm dreaming. That's a fact." He could not bear the alternative. If he were dreaming, he might still be able to save his sanity, survive, endure. But if the land were real, actual. Ah, then the long anguish of his leprosy was a dream, and he was mad already, beyond hope. Any belief was better than that. Better to struggle for a sanity he could at least recognize than to submit to a health which surpassed all explanation. He chewed the gristle of such thoughts for leagues as he trudged along behind Atyarin, but each argument brought him back to the same position. The mystery of his leprosy was all the mystery he could tolerate, accept as fact. It determined his response to every other question of credibility. It made him stalk along at Atyarin's back as if he were ready to attack her at any provocation. Nevertheless, he did receive one benefit from his dilemma. Its immediate presence and tangibility built a kind of wall between him and the particular fears and actions which had threatened him earlier. Certain memories of violence and blood did not recur, and without shame to goad it, his anger remained manageable, discreet. It did not impel him to rebel against Atyarin's uncompromising lead. Throughout that third day, her erect, relentless form did not relax its compulsion. Up slopes and down hillsides, across glens, around thickets, along the western margin of the hills, she drew him onward against his fuming mind and recalcitrant flesh. But early in the afternoon she stopped suddenly, looked about her as if she had heard a distant cry of fear. Her unexpected anxiety startled Covenant, but before he could ask her what was the matter, she started grimly forward again. Sometime later, she repeated her performance. This time Covenant saw that she was smelling the air as if the breeze carried an erratic scent of evil. He sniffed, but smelled nothing. "What is it?" he asked. "Are we being followed again?" She did not look at him.
"Would that Trell were here,"
she breathed distractedly.
"Perhaps he would know why the land is so unquiet."
Without explanation, she swung, hastening away northward once more. That evening, she halted earlier than usual. Late in the afternoon, he noticed that she was looking for something, a sign of some kind in the grass and trees. But she said nothing to explain herself, and so he could do nothing but watch and follow. Then, without warning, she turned sharply to the right, moved into a shallow valley between two hills. They had to skirt the edge of the valley to avoid a large patch of brambles which covered most of its bottom. And in a few hundred yards, they came to a wide, thick copse in the northern hill. Atiaran walked around the copse, then unexpectedly vanished into it. Dimly wondering, Covenant went to the spot where she had disappeared. There he was able to pick out a thin sliver of a path leading into the copse. He had to turn sideways to follow this path around some of the trees, but in 20 feet he came to an open space like a chamber grown into the center of the woods. The space was lit by light filtering through the walls, which were formed of saplings standing closely side by side in a rude rectangle, and a faint rustling breeze blew through them. But interwoven branches and leaves made a tight roof for the chamber. It was comfortably large enough for 3 or 4 people, and along each of its walls were grassy mounds like beds. In one corner stood a larger tree with a hollow center, into which shelves had been built, and these were laden with pots and flasks made of both wood and stone. The whole place seemed deliberately welcoming and cozy. As Covenant looked around, Atiaran set her pack on one of the beds and said abruptly, "This is a waymeet." When he turned a face full of questions toward her, she sighed and went on, "A resting place for travelers. Here is food and drink and sleep for any who pass this way." She moved away to inspect the contents of the shelves, and her busyness forced Covenant to hold on to his questions until a time when she might be more accessible. But while she replenished the supplies in her pack and prepared a meal, he sat and reflected that she was not ever likely to be accessible to him, and he was in no mood to be kept in ignorance. So after they had eaten and Atiaran had settled herself for the night, he said with as much gentleness as he could manage, "Tell me more about this place. Maybe I'll need to know sometime." She kept her face away from him and lay silent in the gathering darkness for a while. She seemed to be waiting for courage, and when at last she spoke, she sighed only, "Ask." Her delay made him abrupt. "Are there many places like this?"
"There are many throughout the land."
"Why? Who sets them up?"
"The lords caused them to be made. Revelstone is only one place, and the people live in many. Therefore, the lords sought a way to help travelers, so that people might come to Revelstone and to each other more easily."
"Well, who takes care of them? There's fresh food here." Atiaran sighed again, as if she found talking to him arduous. The night had deepened. He could see nothing of her but a shadow as she explained tiredly,
"Among the demon dim spawn that survived the desolation, there were some who recalled Lorik Vile's silencer with gratitude. They turned against the Urviles and asked the lords to give them a service to perform as expiation for the sins of their kindred. These creatures, the Wayanhim, care for the Waymeets, helping the trees to grow, providing food and drink. But the bond between men and Wayanhim is fragile, and you will not see one. They serve for their own reasons, not for love of us, performing simple tasks to redeem the evil of their mighty lore."
The darkness in the chamber was now complete. In spite of his irritation, Covenant felt ready to sleep. He asked only one more question. "How did you find this place? Is there a map?"
"There is no map.
A waymeet is a blessing which one who travels accepts wherever it is found, a token of the health and hospitality of the land. They may be found when they are needed. The Wayanhim leave signs in the surrounding land. Covenant thought he could hear a note of appreciation in her voice which clashed with her reluctance. The sound reminded him of her constant burden of conflicts, her sense of personal weakness in the face of the land's strong need, her desires to both punish and preserve him. But he soon forgot such things as the image of waymeets filled his reverie. Enfolded by the smell of the fresh grass on which he lay, he swung easily into sleep. During the night, the weather changed. The morning came glowering under heavy clouds on a ragged wind out of the north, and Covenant met it with a massive frown that seemed to weigh down his forehead. He awoke before Atiaran called him. Though he had slept soundly in the security of the waymeet, he felt as tired as if he had spent the whole night shouting at himself.
Lord Foulsbane by Stephen R. Donaldson. Disc 5. While Atiaran was preparing breakfast, he took out Triok's knife, then scanned the shelves and found a basin for water and a small mirror. He could not locate any soap. Apparently, the Wayanhim relied on the same fine sand which he had used in Atiaran's home. So he braced himself to shave without lather.
Triok's knife felt clumsy in his right hand, and he could not shake lurid visions of slitting his throat. To marshal his courage, he studied himself in the mirror. His hair was tousled wildly. With his stubbled beard, he looked like a rude prophet. His lips were thin and tight, like the chiseled mouth of an oracle, and there was grit in his gaunt eyes. All he needed to complete the picture was a touch of frenzy. Muttering silently, "All in good time," he brought the knife to his cheek. To his surprise, the blade felt slick on his skin, and it cut his whiskers without having to be scraped over them repeatedly. In a short time, he had given himself a shave which appeared adequate, at least by contrast, and he had not damaged himself. With a sardonic nod toward his reflection, he put the blade away in his pack and began eating his breakfast. Soon he and Atiaran were ready to leave the waymeet. She motioned for him to precede her. He went ahead a few steps along the path, then stopped to see what she was doing. As she left the chamber, she raised her head to the leafy ceiling and said softly, "We give thanks for the waymeet. The giving of this gift honors us, and in accepting it we return honor to the giver. We leave in peace." Then she followed Covenant out of the copse. When they reached the open valley, they found dark clouds piling over them out of the north. Tensely, Atiaran looked at the sky, smelled the air. She seemed distraught by the coming rain. Her reaction made the boiling thunderheads appear ominous to Covenant, and when she turned sharply down the valley to resume her northward path, he hurried after her, calling out, "What's the matter?"
"Ill upon evil," she replied. "Do you not smell it? The land is unquiet."
"What's wrong?"
"I do not know," she murmured so quietly that he could barely hear her. "There is a shadow in the air, and this rain. Ah, the land."
"What's wrong with rain? Don't you get rain in the spring?"
"Not from the north," she answered over her shoulder. "The spring of the land arises from the southwest. No, this rain comes straight from Graven Threndor. The cave white staff wrong wielder tests his power. I feel it. We are too late."
She stiffened her pace into the claws of the wind, and Covenant pressed on behind her. As the first raindrop struck his forehead, he asked, "Does this staff really run the weather?"
"The old lords did not use it so. They had no wish to violate the land. But who can say what such power may accomplish?"
Then the full clouts of the storm hit them. The wind scourged the rain southward as if the sky were lashing out at them, at every defenseless living thing. Soon the hillsides were drenched with ferocity. The wind rent at the trees, tore, battered the grass.
It struck daylight from the hills, buried the earth in preternatural night. In moments, Atyaran and Covenant were soaked, gasping through the torrent. They kept their direction by facing the dark fury, but they could see nothing of the terrain. They staggered down rough slopes, wandered helplessly into hip-deep streams, lurched headlong through thickets. They forced against the wind as if it were the current of some stinging limbo, some abyss running from nowhere mercilessly into nowhere. Yet Atyaran lunged onward erect, with careless determination, and the fear of losing her kept Covenant lumbering at her heels. But he was wearying rapidly. With an extra effort that made his chest ache, he caught up to Atyaran, grabbed her shoulder, shouted in her ear, "Stop! We've got to stop!" "No," she screamed back. "We are too late. I do not dare." Her voice barely reached him through the howl of the wind. She started to pull away, and he tightened his grip on her robe, yelling, "No choice! We'll kill ourselves!" The rain thrashed brutally. For an instant, he almost lost his hold. He got his other arm around her, tugged her streaming face close to his. "Shelter!" he cried. "We've got to stop!" Through the water, her face had a drowning look as she answered, "Never! No time!" With a quick thrust of her weight and a swing of her arms, she broke his grip, tripped him to the ground. Before he could recover, she snatched up his right hand and began dragging him on through the grass and mud, hauling him like an unsupportable burden against the opposition of the storm. Her pull was so desperate that she had taken him several yards before he could heave upward and get his feet under him. As he braced himself, her hold slipped off his hand, and she fell away from him. Shouting, "By hell, we're going to stop!" he leaped after her. But she eluded his grasp, ran unevenly away from him into the spite of the storm. He stumbled along behind her. For several long moments, he slipped and scrambled through the flailing rain after her untouchable back, furious to get his hands on her. But some inner resource galvanized her strength beyond anything he could match. Soon he failed at the pace. The rain hampered him as if he were trying to run on the bottom of a breaking wave. Then a vicious skid sent him sledding down the hill with his face full of mud. When he looked up again through the rain and dirt, Atyaran had vanished into the dark storm as if she were in terror of him, dreaded his touch. Fighting his way to his feet, Covenant roared at the rampant clouds, "Hellfire! You can't do this to me!" Without warning, just as his fury peaked, a huge white flash exploded beside him. He felt that a bolt of lightning had struck his left hand. The blast threw him up the hill to his right. For uncounted moments he lay dazed, conscious only of the power of the detonation and the flaming pain in his hand. His wedding ring seemed to be on fire. But when he recovered enough to look, he could see no mark on his fingers, and the pain faded away while he was still hunting for its source. He shook his head, thrust himself into a sitting position. There were no signs of the blast anywhere around him. He was numbly aware that something had changed, but in his confusion he could not identify what it was. He climbed painfully to his feet. After only a moment, he spotted Atyaran lying on the hillside 20 yards ahead of him. His head felt unbalanced with bewilderment, but he moved cautiously toward her, concentrating on his equilibrium. She lay on her back, apparently unhurt, and stared at him as he approached. When he reached her, she said in wonderment, "What have you done?" The sound of her voice helped focus his attention. He was able to say without slurring, "Me? I didn't... nothing." Atyaran came slowly to her feet. Standing in front of him, she studied him gravely, uncertainly, as she said, "Something has aided us. See, the storm is less, and the wind is changed. It blows now as it should. Gravin Threndor no longer threatens. Praise the earth, unbeliever, if this is not your doing." "Of course it's not my doing," murmured Covenant. "I don't run the weather."
There was no asperity in his tone. He was taken aback by his failure to recognize the change in the storm for himself. Atyaran had told the simple truth. The wind had shifted and dropped considerably. The rain fell steadily but without fury. Now it was just a good, solid spring rain. Covenant shook his head again. He felt strangely unable to understand. But when Atyaran said gently, "Shall we go?" he heard a note of unwilling respect in her voice. She seemed to believe that he had, in fact, done something to the storm. Numbly, he mumbled, "Sure," and followed her onward again. They walked in clean rain for the rest of the day. Covenant's sense of mental dullness persisted, and the only outside influences that penetrated him were wetness and cold. Most of the day passed without his notice in one long, drenched push against the cold. Toward evening, he had regained enough of himself to be glad when Atyaran found a waymeet, and he checked over his body carefully for any hidden injuries while his clothes dried by the graveling. But he still felt dazed by what had happened. He could not shake the odd impression that whatever force had changed the fury of the storm had altered him also. The next day broke clear, crisp, and glorious, and he and Atyaran left the waymeet early in the new spring dawn. After the strain of the previous day, Covenant felt keenly alert to the joyous freshness of the air and the sparkle of dampness on the grass, the sheen on the heather, and the bursting flavor of the treasure berries. The land around him struck him as if he had never noticed its beauty before. Its vitality seemed curiously tangible to his senses. He felt that he could see spring fructifying within the trees, the grass, the flowers, hear the excitement of the calling birds, smell the newness of the buds and the cleanliness of the air. Then abruptly Atyaran stopped and looked about her. A grimace of distaste and concern tightened her features as she sampled the breeze. She moved her head around intently, as if she were trying to locate the source of a threat. Covenant followed her example, and as he did so, a thrill of recognition ran through him. He could tell that there was indeed something wrong in the air, something false. It did not arise in his immediate vicinity. The scents of the trees and turf and flowers, the lush afterward of rain, were all as they should be, but it lurked behind those smells like something uneasy, out of place, unnatural in the distance. He understood instinctively that it was the odor of ill, the odor of premeditated disease. A moment later, the breeze shifted, the odor vanished, but that ill smell had heightened his perceptions. The contrast vivified his sense of the vitality of his surroundings. With an intuitive leap, he grasped the change which had taken place within him or for him. In some way that completely amazed him, his senses had gained a new dimension. He looked at the grass, smelled its freshness, and saw its verdancy, its springing life, its fitness. Jerking his eyes to a nearby Aliantha, he received an impression of potency, health, that dumbfounded him. His thoughts reeled, groped, then suddenly clarified around the image of health. He was seeing health, smelling natural fitness and vitality, hearing the true exuberance of spring. Health was as vivid around him as if the spirit of the land's life had become palpable, incarnate. It was as if he had stepped without warning into an altogether different universe. Even Atyaran, she was gazing at his entrancement with puzzled surprise, was manifestly healthy, though her life was complicated by uneasiness, fatigue, pain, resolution. "By hell," he mumbled, "is my leprosy this obvious to her? Then why doesn't she understand?" He turned away from her stare, hunted for some way to test both his eyes and hers. After a moment, he spotted near the top of a hill a guilden tree that seemed to have something wrong with it. In every respect that he could identify, specify, the tree appeared normal, healthy, yet it conveyed a sense of inner rot, an unexpected pang of sorrow to his gaze. Pointing at it, he asked Atyaran what she saw. Soberly, she replied, "I am not one of the Lilianril, but I can see that the Gildan dies. Some blight has stricken its heart. Did you not see such things before?" He shook his head. "Then how does the world from which you come live?" She sounded dismayed by the prospect of a place in which health itself was invisible. He shrugged off her question. He wanted to challenge her, find out what she saw in him. But then he remembered her saying, "You are closed to me." Now he understood her comment, and the comprehension gave him a feeling of relief. The privacy of his own illness was intact, safe. He motioned her northward again, and when, after a moment, she started on her way, he followed her with pleasure. For a long time, he forgot himself in the sight of so much healthiness. Gradually, as the day moved through afternoon into gloaming and the onset of night, he adjusted to seeing health behind the colors and forms which met his eyes. Twice more his nostrils had caught the elusive odor of wrongness, but he could not find it anywhere near the creek by which Atyaran chose to make camp. In its absence, he thought that he would sleep peacefully. But somehow a rosy dream of soul, health, and beauty became a nightmare in which spirits threw off their bodies and revealed themselves to be ugly, rotten, contemptuous. He was glad to wake up, glad even to take the risk of shaving without the aid of a mirror. On the sixth day, the smell of wrong became persistent, and it grew stronger as Atyaran and Covenant worked their way north along the hills. A brief spring shower dampened their clothes in the middle of the morning, but it did not wash the odor from the air. That smell made Covenant uneasy, whetted his anxiety until he seemed to have a cold blade of dread poised over his heart. Still, he could not locate, specify the odor. It keened in him behind the bouquet of the grass and the tangy bracken and the alliantha, behind the loveliness of the vital hills, like the reek of a rotting corpse just beyond the range of his nostrils. Finally, he could not endure it any longer in silence. He drew abreast of Atyaran and asked, "Do you smell it?" Without a glance at him, she returned heavily, "Yes, unbeliever, I smell it. It becomes clear to me." "What does it mean?"
"It means that we are walking into peril. Did you not expect it?"
Thinking, "Hellfire," Covenant rephrased his question. "But what does it come from? What's causing it?"
"How can I say?" she countered. "I am no oracle."
Covenant caught himself on the edge of an angry retort. With an effort, he kept his temper. "Then what is it?"
"It is murder,"
Atyaran replied flatly and quickened her pace to pull away from him. "Do not ask me to forget," her back seemed to say, and he stumped, fuming after it. Cold anxiety inched closer to his heart. By mid-afternoon, he felt that his perception of wrongness was sharpening at almost every step. His eyes winced up and down the hills, as though he expected at any moment to see the source of the smell. His sinuses ached from constantly tasting the odor, but there was nothing for him to perceive, nothing but Atyaran's roaming path through the dips and hollows and valleys and outcroppings of the hills, nothing but healthy trees and thickets and flowers and verdant grass, the blazonry of the earth's spring, and nothing but the intensifying threat of something ill in the air. It was a poignant threat, and he felt obscurely that the cause would be worth bewailing. The sensation of it increased without resolution for some time. But then a sudden change in the tension of Atyaran's back warned Covenant to brace himself scant instants before she hissed at him to stop. She had just rounded the side of a hill far enough to see into the hollow beyond it. For a moment, she froze, crouching slightly and peering into the hollow. Then she began running down the hill. At once, Covenant followed. In 3 strides, he reached the spot where she had halted. Beyond him, in the bottom of the hollow, stood a single copse like an eyot in a broad glade. He could see nothing amiss, but his sense of smell jabbered at him urgently, and Antiaran was dashing straight toward the copse. He sprinted after her. She stopped short just on the east side of the trees. Quivering feverishly, she glared about her with an expression of terror and hatred, as if she wanted to enter the copse and did not have the courage. Then she cried out, aghast,
"Wayanim, Melancurian, ah, by the 7, what evil!"
When Covenant reached her side, she was staring a silent scream at the trees. She held her hands clasped together at her mouth, and her shoulders shook. As soon as he looked at the copse, he saw a thin path leading into it. Impulsively, he moved forward, plunged between the trees. In 5 steps, he was in an open space much like the other waymeets he had seen. This chamber was round, but it had the same tree walls, branch-woven roof, beds, and shelves. But the walls were spattered with blood, and a figure lay in the center of the floor. Covenant gasped as he saw that the figure was not human. Its outlines were generally man-like, though the torso was inordinately long, and the limbs were short, matched in length, indicating that the creature could both stand erect and run on its hands and feet. But the face was entirely alien to Covenant. A long, flexible neck joined the hairless head to the body. 2 pointed ears perched near the top of the skull on either side. The mouth was as thin as a mere slit in the flesh, and there were no eyes. 2 gaping nostrils surrounded by a thick, fleshy membrane filled the center of the face. The head had no other features. Driven through the center of the creature's chest, pinning it to the ground, was a long iron spike. The chamber stank of violence so badly that in a few breaths, Covenant felt about to suffocate. He wanted to flee. He was a leper. Even dead things were dangerous to him. But he forced himself to remain still while he sorted out 1 impression. On seeing the creature, his first thought had been that the land was rid of something loathsome. But as he gritted himself, his eyes and nose corrected him. The wrongness which assailed his senses came from the killing, from the spike, not from the creature. Its flesh had a hue of ravaged health. It had been natural, right, a proper part of the life of the land. Gagging on the stench of the crime, Covenant turned and fled. As he broke out into the sunlight, he saw Atiyaran already moving away to the north, almost out of the hollow. He needed no urging to hurry after her. His bones ached to put as much distance as possible between himself and the desecrated waymeet. He hastened in her direction as if there were fangs snapping at his heels. For the rest of the day, he found relief in putting leagues behind him. The edge of the unnatural smell was slowly blunted as they hurried onward, but it did not fade below a certain level. When he and Atiyaran were forced by fatigue and darkness to stop for the night, he felt sure that there was uneasiness still ahead, that the killer of the Wayanim was moving invidiously to the north of them. Atiyaran seemed to share his conviction. She asked him if he knew how to use the knife he carried. After sleep had eluded him for some time, he made himself ask her, "Shouldn't we have buried it?" She answered softly from her shadowed bed across the low light of the graveling, "They would not thank our interference. They will take care of their own. But the fear is on me that they may break their bond with the Lords because of this." That thought gave Covenant a chill he could not explain, and he lay sleepless for 30 minutes under the cold mockery of the stars. The next day dawned on short rations for the travelers. Atiyaran had been planning to replenish her supplies at a waymeet the previous day, so now she had no spring wine left and little bread or staples. However, they were in no danger of going hungry. Treasure berries were plentiful along their path. but they had to start without warm food to steady them after the cold, uncomforting night, and they had to travel in the same direction that the killer of the Weyenhim had taken. Covenant found himself stamping angrily into the dawn as if he sensed that the murder had been intended for him.